You're listening to the Restless Wanderer podcast by Paul Coulter, and this is part 16 of a series in John's Gospel. John chapter 6, verse 1. After this, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias. And a large crowd was following him because they saw the signs that he was doing on the sick. Jesus went up on the mountain, and there he sat down with his disciples. Now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand. Lifting up his eyes then and seeing that a large crowd was coming towards him, Jesus said to Philip, "Where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat?" He said this to test him, for he himself knew what he would do. Philip answered him, 200 denarii would not buy enough bread for each of them to get a little. One of the disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "There is a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what are they for so many?" Jesus said, "Make the people sit down." Now there was much grass in the place, so the men sat down, about 5,000 in number. Jesus then took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated, so also the fish, as much as they wanted. And when they had eaten their fill, he told his disciples, "Gather up the leftover fragments, that nothing may be lost." So they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with fragments from the 5 barley loaves left by those who had eaten. When the people saw the sign that he had done, they said, "This is indeed the prophet who is to come into the world." Perceiving then that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, Jesus withdrew again to the mountain by himself. Now, as we approach this familiar passage, and it is, of course, the only miracle performed by Jesus that's recorded in all 4 Gospels. And so it's quite a significant event in the ministry of Jesus. But as we approach it, it's worth remembering the context against chapter 5. At the end of chapter 5, as we mentioned in the last episode, Jesus has said that those Jews who wouldn't believe in him had not believed Moses. That's the very end of chapter 5. "If you believed Moses, you would believe me, for he wrote of me. But if you do not believe his writings, how will you believe my words?" And chapter 6 happens after this. It doesn't mean immediately after, but could be some time after this. And certainly it's in a different region of Judea. In chapter 5, he's been in Jerusalem. In chapter 6, it says he goes to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. That's the east shore, the side away from the area where most of the Jews in Galilee lived. What we would call today the Golan Heights, which is, of course, occupied by Israel, but formerly part of Syria. So Jesus is in that region, which is known as a place where both Jews and Gentiles live. But what we're going to read in chapter 6 is very much echoing this idea of the writings of Moses. In what sense did Moses write about Jesus? Well, what did Moses write about? Of course, he wrote about the Passover. Verse 4 says that the Passover was at hand. And as we'll see later on in the chapter, he also refers back to the bread that Moses, the manna that came from heaven in the time of Moses. Moses is mentioned down in verse 32, but we'll probably not get to that until the next episode. So there's a relationship here between Moses' writing and what we're reading and what Jesus does. And this whole chapter is full of Old Testament significance. This is the second Passover that we come across in John's Gospel. There are 3. And we know that Jesus' public ministry was around 3 years, or maybe 3.5 years in length. He died at the 3rd of those Passovers. That was around the time of his death. This is the second. The first was when he was in Jerusalem and he announced his identity. And you can see that back in chapter 2, verses 13 and 23. So the first is about the identity of Jesus. The last is the time of his death. What's the significance of this middle Passover and of the miracle that occurred? Not necessarily on the Passover. That would be, of course, impossible. The Jews would be gathered in Jerusalem, not in this region of Galilee. So it's not that it happened on Passover, but it was close to Passover. Passover was in hand. Well, Jesus goes over, as I said, to the east shore, and a large crowd follows him because they saw the signs he was doing on the sick. And again, we've got to realize that at this point, certainly in that first year of Jesus' ministry, lots of people are following him because of the miracles that he does. They're not necessarily believing in him in the way that Jesus is described in chapter 5. They're simply interested, maybe curious because of these miracles, maybe hoping that he might do a miracle for them, maybe ready to take up arms under his command, hoping that he will become the rebel and king that they had hoped that the Messiah would be. But remember at the end of chapter 5, again, Jesus chastised the Jewish teachers for wanting praise from men and for being ready to believe someone who comes in their own name but not believing in Jesus. In other words, Jesus isn't the kind of Messiah that they hope for. Anyway, this crowd is following him and he goes up a mountain. It doesn't necessarily mean a high mountain. It's a hilly area, but it's somewhere where there is a hill, and he sits down with his disciples. John deliberately tells us that the Passover was at hand, and so there is a significance here. Now, of course, we're going to read about Jesus breaking bread and providing bread for the people, and that might automatically make us think of communion. In fact, the word that's used for Jesus giving thanks is the word, the Greek word that gives us the, well, it's still a Greek word, but we use it in English, Eucharist, to describe communion or the Lord's Supper. But it's not that necessarily that John is describing this as the Lord's Supper, although it's interesting that this gospel doesn't tell us about the institution of the Lord's Supper. And so many people have looked back to this chapter for John's comment on the Eucharist, on the Lord's Supper. So I think there's something in that, but I think we have to be careful not to squeeze the passage into that. But certainly it's in chapter 6 of John that we get prepared for the idea of the significance of what the Lord's Supper will be, because later on in the chapter Jesus will talk about eating his flesh. But one of the reasons we shouldn't see this as being a Eucharist is there's no wine. There is bread, but there's no wine. There's bread and fishes. There's no fish in the Eucharist or the Lord's Supper, and there's no wine in the feeding of the 5,000. So Jesus lifts up his eyes and sees that the large crowd is coming. And he says to Philip, where are we to buy bread so these people might eat? And John tells us very clearly, verse 6, that Jesus is not, Jesus knows what he's going to do. It's not that Jesus has no plan and that he's been caught by surprise and has to come up with an idea. But he wants to test Philip, or maybe to teach Philip and the other disciples something about faith, to see what level of faith they have in him. And of course, Philip can't see beyond the simple economics of food. And so he says, look, it would take 200 denarii. I wouldn't buy enough bread for each of them to get a little. A denarius, a Roman coin, would have been the day's wage for a manual labourer. And 200 days' wages, about 8 months' wages, presumably would have fed an average family for a period of 8 months. But here there's a large crowd, 5,000 men, John tells us. And it is men. It's men in the sense of males. That means when you add in women and children, there might be 15 or 20,000 people. And so such a vast crowd, 200 denarii, 8 months' food for an average family wouldn't even dent that crowd. It wouldn't be enough for them even to have a mouthful. The other disciple who comes on the scene is Andrew. Andrew is interesting, isn't he? He's the one who always brings people to Jesus. He brings his brother Simon Peter to Jesus, and he brings some Greeks to Jesus later on. But here he brings a little boy to Jesus. But he doesn't do it with faith. He too is limited in his horizon, but he's trying to look for what is around him. And he says there's a boy who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. Probably sort of tiny fish, a little bit like anchovies, that would just season the bread a little bit, add a bit of saltiness to it, rather than anything more substantial. And the five barley loaves, these would be very small little cakes or loaves, not a large loaf. I mean, this is a boy's lunch. They're barley loaves as well, which tells us that they're that he's a poor person. It's only the poor who would have used barley loaves. But he brings them to Jesus. Even though Andrew says, what would this be for so many people? But at least the boy is there, and Andrew is looking for something that Jesus can use and can begin with. Five loaves, two fish. By the way, the word that's translated boy could mean not just a boy, but a young man. And some commentators point to a parallel here that if you go back to 2 Kings chapter 4, you have Elijah and or Elisha there, rather. Elisha's servant is called in the Greek translation with the same name, a young man or a boy. Elisha, of course, miraculously feeds the people. So maybe this is portraying Jesus as being greater than Elisha and Elijah, who came before Elisha. Certainly Jesus is being presented as a prophet, but I think it's more than that. Another Old Testament echo is to Psalm 23. It's Mark's gospel that tells us that the grass was green at the time when this happened. Of course, it would have been in the spring around the time of Passover. But the green grass, and if you read on, you'll see in verse 16, Jesus calms the storm, so you've got still waters. So there's also a reference to Jesus here as the shepherd. Although it's Mark that tells us that he looked on the crowd and had compassion on them as sheep without a shepherd. So there's lots of Old Testament resonances here, but John doesn't really draw that shepherd imagery out. But he says, "Let make the people sit down." Again, the other Gospels give us more detail in the way that he organized it, that he got them into groups. And Jesus gives thanks for the bread. It's not that he blesses the bread and giving thanks for our food. Sometimes we think of it in terms of, or people can think of it in terms of a blessing on the food. That's not the point at all. Food does not need a blessing. It is a good gift from God. It is not unclean. What we do when we give thanks is to thank God for the bread, to be as the provider of what we need. And so Jesus gives thanks and he distributes the bread and the fish. And what is the point that John emphasizes? Well, it's the fact that they get as much as they want, verse 11. They eat their fill, verse 12. There is an abundant provision that is here. Mark also tells us about the feeding of the 4,000. And there the lesson seems to be that there is perfect provision for every person's need. Here, there's an emphasis on abundance. Everyone gets as much as they want. They eat their fill. There's no skimping. And it's a miracle. It's not that Jesus encourages the people to share the food that they already had with them, or that everybody just gets a little tiny morsel. It's a miracle of multiplication. It's provision. Jesus provides for the needs of the people. And the 12 are provided for too. They gather up 12 baskets, one each, with fragments that are left behind. And what's the conclusion that the people draw? Verse 14, when they see this sign, they say, "This is indeed the prophet who was to come into the world." Who is the prophet? Deuteronomy 18, verse 15 to 19, where Moses speaks about a prophet like him who will come. And although in one sense that's speaking about all of the prophets who would come after Moses, in a greater sense it was speaking about the Messiah, and people understood that. And the prophet who was to come was one of the figures. Maybe they weren't clear on whether he was the same person as the Messiah, or a forerunner, or a co-worker, because he's a prophet, not a king. But of course Jesus is prophet, priest and king. So they say he is the prophet who's to come. Isn't that the fulfillment of Moses? Isn't that the very point at the end of chapter 5 where Jesus has said that they haven't believed Moses, so how will they believe him? Moses prophesied about his coming. And so the people want to take Jesus and force him to become a king, but he withdraws to the mountain by himself. Let's read then verse 16 to 21. When evening came, his disciples went down to the sea, got into a boat and started across the sea to Capernaum. It was now dark and Jesus had not yet come to them. The sea became rough because a strong wind was blowing. When they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus walking on the sea and coming near the boat, and they were frightened. But he said to them, "It is I, do not be afraid." And then they were glad to take him into the boat, and immediately the boat was at the land to which they were going. So here we have the fifth sign, the fifth miraculous sign that John details for us. In chapter 2, Jesus turned water into wine. In chapter 4, he healed the son of the noble man. In chapter 5, he healed the lame man. And already in chapter 6, he's fed the multitude, the 5,000 men and others. And here now, he walks on the water to the disciples. It's the fifth of seven signs that we'll read about. Chapter 9, we'll see a man who was blind being healed. And in chapter 7, of course, the raising of Lazarus. But it seems a little out of place, perhaps, because in the next episode, we'll move on to verse 22, which talks about how Jesus explains the feeding of the 5,000 and talks about this imagery of bread, the bread of life. John puts it here because it's what happened next. It's found there in Matthew 14 and in Mark 6, and I've already referenced the fact that Mark emphasizes the people as sheep without a shepherd, and just like Psalm 23 says that he makes us lie down in green pastures, he leads us beside still waters. There is a resonance with Psalm 23 in the order of these events. But it also explains how the disciples came back to the opposite side of the shore. Perhaps it's been suggested, some commentators say, that it carries on the theme of Exodus. If Jesus is feeding the people in a place where there is no food, just as Moses superintended the feeding of the people in the desert by manna and quails, so now he's moving, he's going on a journey with his disciples. So after the feeding of the 5,000, when they tried to make him king, Jesus withdrew to be by himself on the mountain. Mark tells us in Mark 6:46 that he went off to pray. That's why he went off. John doesn't tell us that, but he certainly tells us that Jesus withdrew. And the disciples go down and get in the boat and set off towards the west side of the shore of the Sea of Galilee. But Jesus has not joined them yet, and it's dark. John often uses that idea of darkness to symbolize, as he did in John 3, where he said people are lovers of darkness rather than the light, a position of ignorance, a position of being outside God's truth and God's revelation. Again, John chapter 1 talks about the light shining through Jesus, the light coming into the world. And so absence of light and the absence of Jesus go together. Jesus is not present and it's dark in a spiritual sense. And they get caught up in a storm. A strong wind whips up a storm. The Sea of Galilee is apparently well known for storms like this. They can come up quite quickly because the sea itself is about 600 feet beneath the level of the sea. And so it's a lake at about 600 feet under sea level, and the cool air comes down, rushes in, displaces warm air that is over the lake, and so the water gets whipped up into a storm by that wind that blows in. And so the disciples have gone out about 3 or 4 miles, and they see Jesus. It's not told here that they mistook Jesus for a ghost, although we're told that in some of the other Gospels, that they were afraid of Jesus because they thought that that's what he was, that he was a ghost. It's in Mark 6:49 that we're told that they thought he was a ghost. But here, John skips over that detail and simply says that they saw Jesus and they were frightened, but he said, "Don't be afraid, it is I." So they were glad to take him into the boat. Here is the presence of Jesus with them. And immediately the boat was at the land to which they were going. If it's to be read literally, is another dimension of the miracle, isn't it? Not only did Jesus walk on the water, but the boat was transported suddenly to the other side. Of course, it could be figurative that it just seemed that way to them because Jesus was now with them. So what are we to make of this little episode? Well, here is Jesus who has provided for their physical needs. He's provided the food that they needed to sustain them. He's done it miraculously, not just for them, but through them, because remember, the disciples served the bread and the fish to the people. He's provided for a multitude, a crowd of people, many people, thousands of people. But now, here is Jesus, intimately close to the 12, to his friends, his disciples, his servants. And it's not just in public and for crowds that Jesus will provide, but it's in private and for the few that he will be there. But his presence with them is essential. That seems to be the emphasis that John places. Jesus was not with them, but when Jesus was with them, then they reached their destination. He provided and he sustained. And so the lesson here is one of faith in Jesus, isn't it? It's of staying close to Jesus. It's of seeking Jesus through the storms of life. You've probably heard it referred to that way, and that's certainly true. And whether it's a picnic in the countryside or whether it's a storm on the sea, we need Jesus. We need his provision. But we can also trust Jesus to provide what we need in abundance. And also in the lean times, the times of terror and of fear, we can trust Jesus to bring us safely to shore through the storm. It doesn't tell us in this account that Jesus calmed the storm, but we know that he did. But it does tell us that he brought them to their destination. And sometimes in the storms of life, Jesus will calm the storm. He will bring healing. He will bring peace. He will bring a resolution of conflict and of disturbance. On other occasions, he won't, but he'll see you through the storm to the place that he is bringing you to, a place of growth, of greater maturity, of greater faith, or your ultimate heavenly destination to be with him. This is the confidence that we can have in Jesus. He's the one who provides what we need and an abundance that we can enjoy as he did for the crowds. He's the one who goes with us and who carries us and who comes to our rescue when we find ourselves beyond our own control, at the mercy of the storm, and who leads us to our destination.